Last week, we talked about the role of women in the church. This is part of our series on worship. And I told you this week we're going to try to cover in some depth this whole topic of head coverings. It's very controversial. It is, I would say, 90% of the churches out there just absolutely ignore this chapter in the Bible. Typically, if you try to address it, you will just get some kind of a reaction about, oh, well, that's just had to do with the culture of the day. It didn't really, you know, it was just part of their culture. It wasn't really that important. You know, things are different today, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't apply to us, et cetera, et cetera. So what I want to do is there's really only one chapter in the Bible that deals with this on any significant level. I want to go through it verse by verse. So, everybody there? 1 Corinthians 11?
I got to get a cough drop because I got that tickle going on in my throat.
You got another drink?
Yeah, I have a drink here, but I need this. Let's look at verse 1. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1. It's interesting how he starts this chapter. Become imitators of me as I also am of Christ. By the way, I'm reading from my translation, which if you were here 2 weeks ago, I gave you a copy of it. If you weren't here then,
who wasn't here? I only have two copies left, so. You got one?
There's
one. You need one. Okay. That's all I got.
Mark, Marty.
All right. I'm not asking you to trust my translation over your translation that you have there, but I can, if there's any question about my translation, I hopefully will resolve it in this class. The reason I translated it is because, unfortunately, the way it's translated in the New King James Version, it can be misleading. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's not wrong. It's just that it can be misleading if you approach it from certain presuppositions. So I've tried to clarify it from the Greek a little bit more for you in my translation. So here it is. Verse 1. Become imitators of me as I also am of Christ. Yet I applaud you, brothers, because you have remembered all the traditions from me as I gave to you and are retaining them accordingly. Now, this is interesting. In verses 1 and 2, Paul starts out by applauding them for what they were doing right. Right? He's saying, I applaud you because you have remembered all these traditions that I delivered to you. But notice he also says, I want you to follow me or imitate me as I'm imitating Christ. In other words, I'm going to set an example for you and I want you to do like I do. Right? All right. Now, the next verse, he goes on to tell them that he wants them to understand the reasoning behind the tradition that he had given to them and that they were already obeying. See, this, it's interesting that Paul, at some point in the past at this church, had instructed the ladies to wear hats or some kind of a veil while they were in worship. But he apparently didn't explain to them the theological reasons behind it. Now he comes along and he says, I applaud you because you're doing it. Now let me explain to you why you should be doing it. All right, so here's what he says, verse 3. But I desire you to have observed that the head of every man is Christ. The head of the woman is the man. Yet the head of Christ is God. Now, he makes a bold statement here, and what does he back it up with?
Genesis.
What's that?
Genesis.
Did he back it up with anything in the text, or did he just make a claim? Did he quote Genesis? He said, notice he says, I desire you to have observed. It's kind of a strange way of stating it. I desire you to have observed. Have observed is a perfect tense verb in the Greek, which refers to something that happened in the past, but the results continue to the present. So he's saying, I desire right now, I desire for you to have already done something. That's literally what it means, the tenses of the verbs. I desire that you have observed such and such. Now, is he saying, I desire that you understand something I already told you? No. He's saying, I desire that you have observed something. That is, you took the initiative to figure something out, to comprehend something on your own. That's the point he's making. All right, that's what the verb tenses suggest. I desire that you would have gone back and figured this out. And what does he want them to figure out or to have observed? That the head of every man is Christ, that is every man in the congregation, and the head of the woman is the man. How would they have observed that? Okay, and what does Genesis have to say about the subject?
Well, after Adam had and Eve had fallen, and God laid out to them and explained to her that the man would be head over you.
As part of the curse? Somebody says more than that. What is it? What more than that?
Well, the creation itself. God created Adam from the dust of the earth, and then he took a part of Adam and created Eve, as you mentioned last week. Before. He didn't start over with another piece of dirt and created a woman who was equal, not in value, but saying, okay, you guys are both like that.
Which shows, what does that imply? Maybe, but it shows a different purpose. The man and the woman have a different purpose.
Yes.
Isn't that right? And what did God say when he did that?
He said he was making the woman to be a helper to the
man. Okay, but back up. What did he say when he was going to do that? He said, it is not good that the man should be alone, right? I'll make him a helper for him. And so he took part of Adam, part of his flesh, and he made a woman to complete him. Right? The woman was to complete him. Was the woman to be an independent creature? Was the man to be an independent creature? No, because if that was the case, he would have needed a helper, right? Okay, they were to be a unit. Isn't that right? Didn't God create Adam and Eve to be a unit that works together seamlessly? Isn't that right? All right. That should be an observation from the text of Genesis. So he says, I desire you to have observed that the head of every man is Christ. Now, that's a no-brainer. But notice he says, the head of every man is Christ. Now, throughout the passage, he's talking about husbands and wives, Christian husbands and wives in the congregation, right? Every Christian man has a head. That is, someone he is to be subordinate to. Every Christian man is to be subordinate to Christ. He doesn't say that the woman is to be subordinate to Christ, does he? What does he say? The head of, all right, let's look at it again. Yeah, he says the head of every man is Christ. So every man is to be subject to Christ. And the head of the woman is the man, yet the head of Christ is God, that is the Father. So he's drawing a distinction between these different persons or personages, and he's showing kind of a, what's the proper term?
Hierarchy.
A hierarchy, yes, that's the proper term. He's showing a hierarchy of authority and of submission. Christ submits himself to the Father. The Christian man submits himself to Christ. The Christian wife submits herself to her husband. So, does she submit herself to God?
Yes. Indirectly.
Yes.
All right. Let me ask you this, Christian man. Can you submit yourself to the Father without submitting yourself to the Son?
No, probably not.
No, because there is a hierarchy. If you don't submit yourself to the Son, then you're not submitting yourself to the Father. Isn't that right? Yes.
Yep. Christ or loving the Father
Because the Father sent the Son. If the Father sent the Son into the world, if we reject the Son or if we don't submit to the Son, then we're not submitting to the Father. It's impossible.
Even
Yes. Because the Son was sent by the Father. All right? Okay, well, it's the same with the woman and the man in Christ. Can the wife be in submission to Christ by bypassing her husband?
No.
Not according to this passage. And you know, really, if you think about the creation, if you look at Genesis, God commanded the man. It specifically says, God commanded the man, saying, of all the trees of the fruit of the garden, you may eat, but not the one from the knowledge of good and evil, right? And then when Eve sinned, and then Adam sinned, God didn't come and say, Eve, why did you sin, did he? What did he do? Who did he call?
Adam.
He called Adam. He didn't call Eve. He called the man. The man was responsible for his wife. This is the way it's laid out very clearly in Genesis. The man was responsible for his wife. And here's something else that's fascinating. If you read the account in Genesis, who sinned first? Eve sinned. But what does Paul say in Romans chapter 5? By one man, sin entered the world, and death through sin. By one man, by Adam, death came upon all men. You see, when Eve sinned, God did not pass the judgment of death upon mankind. Not until Adam sinned did God pass the judgment of death upon all mankind and all of their descendants. Isn't that interesting? But she sinned first. You'd think she did it first, he should punish the woman. That's not what happened. He punished the man. And the man was the one who was responsible for bringing death into the creation, because he was the one that God had commanded, and he's the one that God had created Eve for to be his helper. If Adam had not sinned, even though Eve had sinned, would death have come and passed upon all mankind?
No.
It passed on all mankind because Adam sinned. And it was because Adam was ultimately responsible for Eve. And Eve had to go through Adam and his authority. So let's look at the text again. I desire you to have observed that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is the man, the head of Christ is God. Now, after having observed all that, and we would have observed that just simply from the Genesis account, and also from just normal Christian teaching, they should have known that Christ was the head of the man. He says, verse 4, every man praying or prophesying with veiled head disgraces his head. Now, when it says veiled head, what does it mean? It's talking about this part of his body, right? He's covering his head. If he's praying or prophesying with his head covered, it says he's disgracing his head. Now, you have to understand that he uses the word head in two different ways in these passages. Isn't that right? Because he just said that the head of the man is Christ. So he's using head for this part of your body, but he's also using head in a metaphorical sense, that is, the one to whom you are directly responsible. Okay? That's also a head in a metaphorical sense. So he is disgracing Christ. That's what he's saying. A man who is praying, and remember, he's talking here about in the congregation when we gather together to be a temple of God for his spirit. The man who is praying or prophesying with his head veiled is disgracing his head, that is Christ. You'll see I have it capitalized there because that's what it's talking about. He's disgracing the one to whom he is to be subordinate to. In verse 5, but every woman praying or prophesying with unveiled head disgraces her head. Should say her head. I think I have his head there. That's wrong. No, I have it right. Disgraces her head. That is her husband. That's the one to whom she is to be subordinate. For it is one and the same as having been sheared. For if a woman is not veiled, let her shear herself. The word sheared here is a term, it's a Greek word that's used for shearing sheep. They cut the hair, you know, right, just about, almost down to the skin, you know, completely off. Just shave it all off. All right. Now, why do you think, let's try to get into Paul's head here a little bit. Why do you think he says this? What is it about shaving a woman's head that is considered to be disgraceful? You have to know a little bit about customs in those days, but if you know anything about ancient customs, having a woman go around with her head shaved, her hair shaved off, was a way of dishonoring her. And do you know under what circumstances that was carried out in ancient times? What's that? Yeah, that was one of the main things. All right, if a woman was caught committing adultery and cheating on her husband, one of the things that they did is they shaved her head as a way to disgrace her, so everyone knew that she was an adulteress. All right, and so it was considered to be very disgraceful. Margaret, go ahead.
It was even done in World War II.
Yes, it was.
In France.
Yes. In fact, I've seen photographs of that. It was done during the war to disgrace women for various reasons, not only adultery, but adultery was one of the big reasons why it was done. So the Apostle Paul here is saying, if the woman is not going to veil her head, then she should just shave it off. That's what he says. Isn't that right? All right, we'll think about why that's the case in a minute. Verse 6. For if the woman is not veiled, let her shear herself. Yet if it is disgraceful for a woman to shear herself or to be sheared, let her be veiled. So it's one or the other is what he's saying. What's not acceptable is to be unveiled without just shaving off the hair. So the point is the hair is being covered. All right, now let's go on. Verse 7. For indeed, he begins to give some of his reasoning here behind this. For indeed, a man is not required to veil the head. Why? Being the image and the glory of God. Now, why does Paul say that, first of all? What is he referring to when he says the man is to be the image and glory of God? What is? But wasn't the woman also created in God's image? Indirectly. Go ahead, Jordan.
I'll just say it says in God's image he created them. It uses the plural pronoun in Genesis.
Yes, it does. It says he created man in his own image, and then it goes on to use the plural after that. So together as a unit, they were created in the image of God. So why else? Why does he say that the man is the image or the glory of God here? And for that reason, he should not veil his head. Anybody? What did God say about Adam when he created him? He said that man was to have dominion over all the earth, over the fish, the birds, everything. That is, under God, man was to take dominion, that is to be the authority over his creation. In fact, Psalms talks about that too, doesn't it? And Hebrews does as well, quoting from that passage. Man was to have dominion over the creation. Does man now have dominion over the creation? You know what? This is important. Let's look at it. Hebrews chapter 2. Verse 5. For he, that is God, has not put the world to come, of which we speak, in subjection to angels. But one testified in a certain place, saying, and here he begins to quote Psalm chapter 8. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you take care of him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. You see that? God has crowned man with glory and honor, and set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. Now, when David wrote that psalm, he was talking about the passage in Genesis where God told Adam to take dominion over all of the creation. Eve was there as his helper in that, but Adam was primarily the one who was put in charge of that. Now, I asked before, does man now have dominion over God's creation? Why? He sinned against God. God put a curse on the whole thing, right? Well, look what it continues in verse 8. He says, for in that he put all in subjection under him, that is, under Adam. He left nothing that is not put under him. That's what God did. But then he says, but now we do not yet see all things put under him. In other words, what God said about Adam in Genesis, he's saying, hasn't happened yet. It hasn't come to pass yet that man is in his rightful place ruling over God's creation. Which is why he said back in verse 5, for he has not put the world to come of which we speak into subjection of angels. But, and then he quotes this psalm where God says he's putting it under the subjection of man. Not angels, but man. And then he goes on to say, but yet we don't see it under subjection of man yet. But what do we see? Verse 9. But we do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels. That is, he became human, he became man, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, that is Jesus, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, that is, it's all for him, and it was all created by him, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. That is, he, God, or Christ, calls us his brothers. That's what he's saying. Now, again, in the context, he was talking about the age to come. That the in the age to come, the creation is going to be under the dominion of man. Because in this age, it's not yet under the dominion of man because of Adam's sin. But Christ came so that we could become heirs and co-heirs with Christ over the creation. All right, that's the point that he's making here in Hebrews. Now, notice in this psalm, he specifically says that God crowned Adam with glory and honor. All right, quoting from Psalm 8. He glorified Adam, and he put him over the works of his hands. Now, go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. The man, Adam, forfeited his right to rule over God's creation because of sin. And he introduced death into the creation because of his sin. Right? However, how is all of that reversed? How does man regain the right to reign over God's creation? Through Christ. Only through Christ. Christ came as the second Adam. Paul says that. Right? The new Adam. The second Adam, or the last Adam. 1 Corinthians 15. Right? And he brings many brothers with him to be co-heirs together with him. And so the glory of the man here is the glory of being the authority to reign in God's creation. And remember, originally Eve was created from Adam's rib to be his helper and his you could call her a co-ruler, if you will, with Adam. But Adam was the primary one. All right, does that make sense? All right, so having all that understanding, let's go back to this passage. He says, verse 7, for indeed a man is not required to veil the head, being the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of the man. That is, she reflects his glory. The man is reflecting the glory of God through Christ. He does not cover his head because it's when you cover your head, it's a symbol of submission. The man does not cover his head because he is the representative of Christ here. Well, Christ isn't here. He's the representative of Christ. By not covering his head, it's a sign that he's taking his rightful place. But the woman was commanded to cover her head because she's the glory of the man, or she's reflecting the glory of the man. Look at verse 8. Man is not from woman, but woman is from man. And the man was also not created through the woman, but the woman through the man. Because of this, the woman is required to hold authority upon her head because of the angels. Now, authority, he says authority, he's talking about a symbol of authority. The head covering he's talking about is a symbolic thing. It's not a fashion statement. Okay? It's not, the importance of it isn't the color it is or how big it is or how many flowers it has on it or how much of your head it covers. I mean, that's not the point. The point is it's a symbolic thing, right? So I'm not going to judge anybody's head covering or anything like that. Question. Why does he say that for this reason the woman is required to hold authority upon her head because of the angels? What do the angels have to do with this? Do you read anything about the angels in the Genesis account of Eve's creation or any of that stuff? Do you read anything about that? There's nothing about it, is there? Why do you think he brings the angels into this? Go ahead, Jordan.
I forget where it says that even the angels long to look into these things.
Yeah.
Like the mystery of the gospel.
Yeah.
I'm assuming he's saying that angels are looking at it to see that we are reflecting God's nature while on earth. I'm assuming. Because if we're the children of God by adoption, then the angels are kind of watching to see how we fulfill those roles.
They are watching, and the scripture does say that. But there's a very specific reason why he brings up the angels. I think I saw Spencer's hand. Well, in the context, he's talking about the worship of the congregation together. All right, whether or not that's you do that apart from that is not addressed in this passage. So I'm not going to get into that. But as far as the context of this passage, it's only talking about while we're gathered together for worship. That's very clear from the verses that preceded. He's talking about observing the Lord's Supper and all that. So that's pretty obvious. All right. Yes, Stephen.
Is he talking about all angels here, or
okay, now that you're on the right track. What was the sin of Satan? What did he rebel against? God's authority. He rebelled against God's authority. What did the angels, what was the sin of the angels who followed Satan? Angels rebelled against God. There was a great rebellion of angels against God. The scripture's pretty clear about that. It's in 2 Peter. It's also in Jude. What was the sin of the angels who rebelled against God? Well, I'll tell you what. I'll show you. Let's go to Jude chapter 1.
They left
their first estate. Yes. You know what that means?
They stepped outside of the boundaries that God set for them.
Yes. That's exactly what it means. But I want to read it right directly out of Jude. Verse 6. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain. And the Greek word literally means rank. What does that imply? You know, in the military, there are all kinds of ranks. You know, you got generals and colonels and, I don't know, Spencer could fill me in on the rest of them. Because he was in there. But you've got all these different ranks, right? Everybody has their slot, their position. Everybody is under the authority of somebody above them. And they have other people under them, unless you're private, right? You got other people that are subordinate to you. So you have a certain rank. This passage says that the angels who did not keep their proper rank, that is, they rebelled against the authorities that were put over them. What does he say? But left their own abode. He has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for judgment of the great day. Wow. The angels who sinned against God by not submitting to those other angels that were put over them. They were put in a certain hierarchy. Some of them sinned. God says they are going to be judged for that. This is what their sin was. All right. Now, let me ask you this. How did Satan deceive Eve? We know what Satan's sin was, right? You know what it says in Isaiah 14. About Lucifer, right? How art thou fallen from heaven, Lucifer, blah, blah, blah. What does he say? You said in your heart, I will ascend. What's that? Yeah. I will put my throne, and all that kind of stuff. He's going to ascend above the authority and the rank that he was given. He was given a high rank. He's going to ascend above that. All right. Now, that was Satan's sin, was pride, and refusing to accept the subordination that he was put under. He refused to accept it. He stepped outside of those bounds. That was the same sin that the angels committed, that we just read about in Jude. And it's the same thing that Satan used to tempt Eve. Exactly the same thing. What did he say to Eve? You shall not surely die. God knows that in the day that you eat of that fruit, you will become as gods. Right? Not you little peon humans. Not in a subordinate role to your husband, but you will be as gods. See, he deceived her with that. And she didn't know any better. And she bought into the whole thing, right? And she sinned. Dissatisfaction with the appointed role that God had given her is the way Satan exploited her, right? And he used the very same temptation that had been hatched in his own heart, the same temptation that had been hatched in the hearts of all the other angels, fallen angels who followed Satan's example. And so let's go back to the text here. He says, because of this, the woman is required to hold authority upon her head because of the angels. Now, if the woman who is put by creation in a subordinate role to her husband, she's put there by God. If she's not satisfied with that, if she says, I want equality, not in worth, because women are, you know, just as valuable as men, but in rank, I want equality. If she says that, she is succumbing to the very same sin that the devil succumbed to, that the fallen angels succumbed to. In fact, the Apostle Paul says that when you are choosing your elders in the congregation, do not put a novice as an elder. You know why? Lest he be lifted up with pride and fall into the same condemnation as the devil. That's what it says. Oh. See, some people, if they're put in a position where they're under somebody else, that's not good enough for them, and they want to elevate themselves, and they want to reject authority. Right? They reject the authority over them, and in doing so, they're committing the very same crime that God did. Now, go ahead, Stephen.
It just occurred to me that the devil tried the same thing with Christ when he tempted him in the wilderness. He basically said, you don't have to submit to the cross. I will give you everything if you bow down and worship me.
Yeah.
He's trying to get him to not submit to the Father's will.
Yeah. If a woman willingly submits to her husband, not because she has to, not because there's some consequences if she doesn't, but if she simply says, this is what God designed me to do, and this is what God commanded me to do, therefore, it must be best, and therefore, I'm going to do this willingly with my whole heart because I want to be pleasing to God and I want to fulfill the thing that God has designed for me. If she does that, what does that say to all those angels who rebelled against God? Isn't it a rebuke to them? Isn't it condemnation of them? It is. It's condemnation of them. Paul says in Ephesians, I think it's chapter 3, that the church, that is through the church, God is making known to the angels and the principalities the counsel of his will. That is, by demonstrating through us as a body, through each individual person, playing their designed role, he is demonstrating his will and his wisdom to the angels and the principalities and powers who are watching everything that's going on here right now. They're looking in on this service. They're watching us. And when they see women who say, I want to submit to what God has for me, and I want to do it willingly with my whole heart, you ladies are condemning those fallen angels. You're condemning them and showing that God is just in his judgment of them. Yes.
Why does it just say angels, not fallen angels or demons? If
Because it's a demonstration both to the angels who rebelled and the angels who did not rebel. Because it vindicates the angels who willingly submitted to the authority that they were placed under. It vindicates them, and it condemns those who sinned against God. So in both sense, it's testimony to the angels. See, what we're doing here is not just insignificant. What we're doing here has far-reaching ramifications, not just here, not just in Tampa, and not just on the internet, but even into the angelic realm. Those who are watching us and who are observing us, they are learning, and they're being either vindicated or they're being condemned by our own actions. It's pretty remarkable. You remember, I mean, I spent weeks talking about Philippians, excuse me, Philippians 2. Remember what that said? Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, right? Who in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation. Actually, no reputation is not a good translation. It literally says he emptied himself in the New American Standard, which is better. He emptied himself. He became obedient. He took the form of a servant, it says, right? And then being found in fashion as a man, he what? He humbled himself. He became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And for that reason, God has highly exalted him and given him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. That's what it says in Philippians chapter 2. Now, what did Jesus do? He's the perfect example. Satan is the perfect example of the wrong way to react to authority. The fallen angels are the perfect example of the wrong way to react to authority. Jesus is the perfect example of the right way to react to authority. What did he do? Did he seek to exalt himself? That's what the devil did. The devil sought to exalt himself. Spencer.
Kind of on topic, but it's in this passage. Mm-hmm. Man with long hair.
Yeah.
Does not even nature teach you that if a man has long hair, it is an honor to him?
Yeah. There was a certain condition where the Jews were allowed to grow their hair long, and that was when they had a Nazarite vow. And Paul took a Nazarite vow too, but it was a temporary thing. All right, it wasn't something that you did all the time. All right, in this case, he's talking about to be effeminate, which was different than that particular case. But actually, I'm going to get to that in just a minute, okay? The point I want you guys to see is that what God values here, from the perspective of a woman, is the attitude that Jesus had in Philippians chapter 2. And that is, he stepped down. Right? Stepped down from equality with God. He emptied himself. He became a man, the Bible says. That's quite a step down. But it was voluntary, wasn't it? See, that's the whole point of Philippians chapter 2. It wasn't that the Father twisted his arm and said, I want you to do this, now get out there and do it. It says he emptied himself. That's what it says. He chose the low path. He chose the path of submission. And what was the result? Was he always going to be the bottom guy on the totem pole? What was the result? See, the passage doesn't end there with him setting all that aside. The passage doesn't end there with him taking on humanity. The passage doesn't end there with becoming obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. The passage ends with, for this reason, the Father has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. What does Jesus say about those who exalt themselves? And what about those who humble themselves? Oh. So you humble yourself before God, he will exalt you. James says the same thing. He will lift you up. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he will lift you up. See? But when you exalt yourself against what God has commanded, he's going to cut you down. When you humble yourself, he is going to lift you up. That's a principle that we see all throughout the scriptures. Okay? Now, for very important theological reasons, the Apostle Paul, and primarily based in Genesis, the Apostle Paul says that the ladies are to cover their heads while during this time of worship. Now, the question then is why? And I want you to look at verse... let's look at verse 13. Judge in yourselves. Is it appropriate for a woman to be praying unveiled? Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him, yet if a woman should have long hair, it is a glory to her because her long hair has been given her as a cape? Okay, so he appeals to their just good sense of judgment, all right? And he says that nature even teaches you that this is true. But I want you to look at the last part of verse 15. It says her hair is given her as a cape. If you're reading from the New King James, it says her hair is given her as a covering. And that's the word that's misleading in this passage. And I'll tell you why it's misleading. Because they translate the verb that means to veil herself as covered. And then they translate this noun as covering. But these words are not even remotely related to each other. The word that's translated a covering here at the end of verse 15, and I have as a cape, is a word that appears in the Greek Old Testament several times. I can give you some references for it. It's in, you can jot these down if you want. It's in Deuteronomy 22:12, Judges 8:26, Ezekiel 27:7, and here's a very interesting one in Genesis 49:11, where it refers to the Messiah's cape. The Messiah is going to wear a cape. Not like Superman, but... The word refers to a elaborate, usually very expensive, outer garment that was worn over the shoulders, usually worn by people of means. All right? In fact, wherever it appears in the Old Testament, it seems to be something worn by a king or something of that nature. All right? Talks about it being purple and things like that, colors that were associated with those kinds of things. It never, ever, ever was worn over the head. That's something you have to understand. This word for this type of a garment, which was thrown around the shoulders, never is worn over the head. It's not a hoodie. All right? It's an overgarment that was made to make kind of a fashion statement because it was something that the wealthy had. Okay? Now, when he says her hair was given to her as a cape, what he's saying is her long hair, which is beautiful. Notice he said it's a glory to her. Did you see that? It says her long hair is a glory to her. And he says her long hair is given to her as or instead of an elaborate overgarment, which... if you were a woman back in the day and you had one of these garments, that would be a glory to you. Because when people see you wearing that, they say, ah, here's somebody of means. Here's somebody who's upper crust. You know, that sort of thing. All right? It was a fashion statement. So what he's saying is her long hair has been given to her as a glory to her, to bring glory to her. Her hair has been given to her for that means instead of an elaborate cape or something that else that brings glory to her. You know, there are poor women who had long, beautiful hair. They couldn't afford one of those elaborate capes. But yet, they still could be beautiful. Now, let me ask you this. I want you to, knowing all these facts, I want you to try to think in your mind, why would the Apostle Paul tell the ladies to cover that up? Who said that? Exactly. So that she would not bring glory to herself at the exclusion of her man. That's the point. The point of this passage is the woman is to be in submission to her husband. However, the woman is a lot better looking than her husband. All right? She's got a beautiful head of hair. And she's probably a lot prettier in the face than that scruffy looking thing on his face. You know that? That beard thing he's got going on. When people look at the couple, who do they look at? They admire the guy. Wow, he's a nice-looking guy. No, they usually admire the woman. Because the woman has been given an appearance and a manner that is very attractive, typically. Okay? She's attractive. She gets attention. Just like having this big, elaborate garment brings attention to a woman, God has given her this long hair in the same way to be a glory to her. He says it is a glory to her. Isn't that right? And so when you appear before God as a couple, and the woman is all decked out and looking all beautiful, and the guy's just all plain looking, like me, right? The attractive one is the woman. She's the one who gets the attention and the glory. And what God is saying here, what Paul is saying here is for the ladies, he's asking them to cover that up in a symbolic way. It doesn't mean you have to cover every hair. The point is, in a symbolic way, you're saying, no, don't look at me and my, you know, oh, my pretty face and my pretty hair. Don't look at me. My husband is the one who is made in the image of God. And I'm submitting myself to my husband. All right? And this is the reason why he said that. Is that, can you guys get that? Can you understand that? So what it is, it's a voluntary way for the lady to say, no, don't look at me and don't bring glory to me. I want to bring glory to my husband because he's the one who is made to be to reign over the creation. He's the one who God made for this role. And I was made to be his helper, not to outshine him. Okay, not to be the one who gets all the attention to the exclusion of him. But I'm going to veil my glory so that he'll be the glory of Christ. All right, that's the point that Paul's making in this passage. And a lot of people don't understand what's going on here. And they say, oh, well, the hair is given to her for covering. That means she doesn't have to veil her head. But then if that's the case, then he's completely undid all that he just said in the previous verses. He uses the term that she is to be veiled and covered all up. And if she's not veiled, then have her shave it off. Doesn't make any sense if he's saying that her hair is her covering. Then what's the point? Why is he telling her to veil it? So it doesn't make any sense that way. But that's the point that he's making. So, excuse me. So what do we draw from all this? What do we draw from all this? What is the head covering then? It's a symbol that the wife is submitting to the place that God has given her husband. She's saying voluntarily, I'm going to take a secondary role because that's what I was created. I was created to be his helper, not to be the one to outshine him. Okay? So I'm going to do this as a way of doing it. Now, look at verse 16 and we'll close. He says, but if anyone seems to be obstinate, we have no such practice, nor the congregations of God. Now, what does he mean by that? Some people say, well, see, Paul's saying, we don't do that. We don't know that you don't have to veil your head because the churches don't do that thing. That's not what he's saying. He's saying being obstinate is not a custom in the churches. That's what he's saying. If anyone is obstinate about this, if you want to be bullheaded about it and say, I won't do that, he's saying you're going contrary to the practices of the churches of God. Notice he says the churches of God or the congregations of God. What he's saying is this is the custom of the Christian churches. And if you're being obstinate about it, then you're going outside of the custom of the Christian churches or the congregations of God. So the question comes down to one very simple thing. Do we want to fulfill the roles that God has given us? Do we want to, in a symbolic way, make that statement to the angels? Do we want to do that? Or do we want to do the opposite of that and be lifted up with pride and say, I'm sorry, but that doesn't apply to me, and fall into the same condemnation as the devil, which is ultimately what it boils down to. Yes?
Is there a parallel meaning to this with the Jewish people that wear their top as they rejected Jesus? And they,
you know, there have been people who have actually drawn that conclusion that it seems to be a coincidence that the Jewish men cover their heads when they pray, which is the custom amongst Jews, and they are also the ones who reject the authority of Christ. You know, Paul says here that the man is not to cover his head because if he does, he's dishonoring his head, and the Jewish males are dishonoring Christ ultimately, by Paul's standard here, by covering their heads when they do that. So,
when did they start using the yarmulke?
Jews? Yeah. Well, the yarmulke is only one manner of covering. There's actually statements, even in the Old Testament, that the priests had coverings for their heads.
So why the change? And where did that happen?
Because it changed with the early church. The early church did not just adopt the customs of the Jews. Yes, the Jewish women covered their heads, but the men also covered their heads, but the church came along and the men were to uncover their heads when they prayed because they are the glory of Christ.
So it changed once Christ came, then that's when they
were. That's apparently, as far as I can tell, that's when the change occurred. And the change didn't occur with women. The women always covered their heads when they prayed. It was with the men. Yes.
You know, the Jerusalem Council, they were asking, what do we need to obey with the law? How come they didn't bring this issue up with it? Like, they only mentioned, like, don't eat things strangled animals, don't eat blood, you know, don't worship idols, or that, serve. I mean, they didn't really address
They didn't address a lot of things. They didn't address fornication. Well, they did address fornication, but they didn't address stealing. They didn't address a whole lot of different things. What they addressed was the issues that were brought up by those Judaizers that were coming around behind Paul and saying, if you listen to Paul, that's not enough. You have to be circumcised and obey all the law in order to be saved. They were addressing that issue. They weren't addressing all the peripheral issues. Now, I'm not saying this is a really big issue. I don't think it's that big of an issue. All right. But if we're going to teach the whole counsel of God, we can't just skip over this chapter as much as we would like to. All right? I think it's important that we understand it. Yeah.
The other thing, too, is that they try to say, well, this was the custom and all that. But like Paul said, that if a person thinks himself to be spiritual or a prophet, let him know that the things that I teach are the commandments of the Lord.
Yeah, that's in chapter 14.
So there was only a couple of exceptions where Paul made sessions where he said, okay, I say not the Lord. And it was very clear and specific about those specific things. But everything else that he writes, we have to, and I would believe, assume rightfully that these are the commandments of the Lord. And there's a reason to specify for this. And if you look at society, how we have degraded so much, with the women's lib movement and everything in the rebellion, that's a rebellion to God. Mm-hmm. And look at the shackled homes, and look at how they just, everything's gone morally wrong. They have all this rejection of the hierarchy that God has set. And if you look at the families that are trying to do these things the right way, you can see a more healthy environment in a family.
Well, yeah, that's true. Let me say this also, that this is a symbolic gesture. That was a tradition for all the churches. That's very clear from this passage, right? It was a symbolic gesture. And you notice that Paul, nowhere in here does Paul actually command the women to do that. What he commands them to do is if they won't do it, then shave off your hair. And why does he say that? Why does he say if they won't be veiled, then shave off their hair? Why does he say that? Because it's that glory thing again. Their hair is there to bring glory to them. So if you're not going to cover it up, then shave it off. Because that won't bring glory to you anymore. That was the point that he was making.
All right.
What's that? And it was a shameful thing. Right. So, all right. Enough said on that subject. And everyone has to make their own choices, their own decisions. But I encourage you to have the same mind that Jesus had, which was not pride, and it was to humbly accept the lowest place. And the reward is incredible that was given to him. And for you ladies, the reward will be great as well in the kingdom of God.